The disastrous end of the Hindenburg and the dramatic radio description of its demise. That's the focus of this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
Lakehurst, New Jersey. The German dirigible Hindenburg is on fire. How serious is the blaze cannot be determined at this time, but it is reported that the entire ship is involved. This bulletin is from the Press Radio Bureau.
The Zeppelin was a class of dirigible balloon that utilized a rigid skeletal structure to determine its shape. The name comes from its German inventor, Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin, who constructed his first such airship in 1900. The most famous or infamous of Zeppelins was the Hindenburg, built in 1936 and named for the German military leader and statesman Paul von Hindenburg. It was a huge vehicle, 804 feet long, over 2.5 lengths of an NFL football field, and with a gas capacity of 6,710,000 cubic feet. Because of political restrictions, it used highly flammable hydrogen rather than the non-flammable helium gas. As we'll hear, the use of hydrogen was a calamitous mistake. The Nazi government of Adolf Hitler had made sure the swastika was prominently displayed on the Hindenburg's body, which no doubt caused quite a few hearts to go thump in ethnic neighborhoods of New York City when it circled Manhattan Island on its arrivals and departures from the United States. It had made 10 transatlantic trips in 1936 and had become affiliated with American Airlines for the continuance of its passengers' travel once in the U.S. On its first voyage of the 1937 travel season, the Hindenburg carried 97 passengers and crew into the airfield at Lakehurst, New Jersey, on the evening of the 6th of May, 1937. In a somewhat unusual circumstance, present to describe its arrival were announcer Herbert Morrison and recording engineer Charles Nielsen of Chicago radio station WLS. In 1974, Morrison was asked to introduce a record album of his reportage of that tragedy. And in this introduction, he explained the circumstances that led to his being at Lakehurst.
Hello, this is Herb Morrison speaking. It is now more than 37 years since I described the crash of the German dirigible, the Hindenburg, at Lakehurst, New Jersey, on May 6th, 1937. Before you listen to the actual description of the crash, I would like to take a few minutes to tell you how this broadcast occurred. Through the years, many people believe that it just happened, that I was there by more or less an accident. But let me assure you, it was a carefully planned coverage of the arrival of the Hindenburg on its first anniversary flight from Germany to the United States. The airship had made many successful and enjoyable flights across the Atlantic in 1936. Coverage of the anniversary flight happened in this manner. I was working as a staff member of radio station WLS in Chicago, and in the early part of 1937, terrible floods hit the Ohio and Mississippi valleys. I had been invited by American Airlines to be part of a group of newsmen who were to be flown down over the Mississippi Valley to observe the effect of the disastrous flood. Following this flight, I made a number of successful appeals to WLS listeners for funds to help the Red Cross in its relief work. I established a friendly relationship with officials of the American Airlines and, as a result, was asked if I would like to fly down to Lakehurst, New Jersey early in May to watch the landing of the Hindenburg on this first anniversary flight. Naturally, I said I would, and this was in February, and slightly 2 more months remained before we would be flying to Lakehurst. So I put my interest in aviation to work. My interest had been of long standing. I'm a pilot myself, having started flying in 1929, in the days when you flew in old World War I planes, and as they say, by the seat of your pants. The Zeppelins used in World War I always intrigued me, and when the giant Hindenburg was built, I became greatly interested in it. In the several-month period between February and May, I spent many hours studying the structure, safety, and flying characteristics of the dirigible. As the time approached for the flight to Lakehurst, I thought this trip would be wonderful if I could bring back a description of the landing and interviews with some of the Chicago passengers on board. For some years, in fact, from the time I started broadcasting in 1930, I'd been wanting to advance an idea that special events, like this Hindenburg flight, could be covered by use of electrical transcription equipment. That is, make a record of the event at the scene, make interviews and so forth, then take the record back to the station for broadcasting. I knew you could do it if there was AC current available at the point of the broadcast. Well, such current was available at the Naval Air Station at Lakehurst, and Commander Charles Rosendahl, who's now Admiral Rosendahl, assured me that we would receive full cooperation for a broadcast. My next problem was getting permission from WLS to take recording equipment and one of the station engineers with me to Lakehurst. At first, the idea was frowned on, but later approved, and I was assigned a most capable and loyal engineer, Charles Nielsen. Charlie and I worked out the details, and then I asked American Airlines if they would agree to my taking an engineer with me. They said yes, and they would take care of flying our heavy equipment, too. Now, this was long before the days of light equipment and tape recorders such as we have today. On arrival at Lakehurst, we set up our equipment, and then you're going to hear what happened. Incidentally, this was the first record ever broadcast on the National Broadcasting Company in its 10-year history.
How do you do, everyone? We're greeting you now from the Naval Air Base at Lakehurst, New Jersey, from which point we're going to bring you a description of the landing of the mammoth airship Hindenburg, which was due here in America this morning at dawn, completing the first transatlantic crossing of the 1937 season. Charlie Nielsen, one of our WLS engineers, is here at my side working the controls. We both flew down from Chicago yesterday afternoon aboard one of the giant new 21-passenger flagships of American Airlines. It took us only 3 hours, 55 minutes to fly nonstop from Chicago to New York. When we landed at Newark, we found another flagship of American Airlines waiting to take us to Lakehurst with our equipment when we were ready to go. And incidentally, American Airlines is the only airline in the United States which makes connections with the Hindenburg. And as we came in for a landing on the runway of the field here at Lakehurst, we could easily see that a great event was about to take place. Last-minute preparations were being made to handle the landing of this great ship. With just 1 year ago today, May 6th, that the Hindenburg made its first regular passenger flight to America, the flight that inaugurated the first air service across the Atlantic. So this occasion is doubly significant. It is the first anniversary of the inauguration of the service and marks the first flight of this year. The Hindenburg left Frankfurt, Germany, Tuesday evening, rather, at 7:30 their time. And for better than 2.5 days, they've been speeding through the skies over miles and miles of water here to America. It was due to land at Lakehurst this morning at dawn, but we learned after our arrival at Newark that adverse wind conditions had been encountered over the area surrounding Newfoundland, which slowed the speed of the ship considerably. Now, when I say that it slowed the speed of the ship, by that I mean the speed of the travel over water or land. Now, the ship keeps in the air a constant speed, which is in the neighborhood of 80 miles an hour. If it is flying into a wind of, say, 30 miles an hour, as it has been all last night, the 30 miles an hour must be subtracted from its airspeed to give us the speed it travels over land or water, which would be 50 miles an hour when we make the subtraction. Now, if we had received a tailwind, one that would help it along, then we'd have added the 30 miles to the airspeed, and it would have helped the Hindenburg to travel over land at a total of 110 miles an hour. In that case, the ship would have come in ahead of time this morning or long before dawn. The Hindenburg made its first appearance shortly after noon today over the New York metropolitan area. All during Wednesday night, Charlie Nielsen and I stayed in constant touch with all the radio communication systems, which were in steady contact with the airship, getting last-minute bulletins and so forth. And are we glad the seats in the American Airlines passenger office in Newark are air cushions? We warmed them plenty all through the night, believe you me. On the Hindenburg are 39 passengers and a crew of 61. The Hindenburg circled over New York and is pointed for the base here at Lakehurst, where we are now broadcasting this description. Now, you may wonder why the ship didn't land the moment that it arrived at Lakehurst. As a word of explanation, these giant ships cannot be landed, or perhaps, should not be landed at midday. The reason being there are so many shifting surface winds that it would bounce and toss the ship around too much. Now, it must either be landed early in the quiet of the dawn or during the quiet period just around sunset. And it's just about sunset and almost the end of twilight right now. And raining as hard as could be. Now, those are ideal times, early in the morning or late in the evening. Winds and weather conditions have proven to be most satisfactory. In other words, nothing's left to chance or made subject to unnecessary risk. Safety comes first, as it always should. Now, the ship has been over the field several times. It's a beautiful field here. It's a sort of a sandy and grass combination with tarvia or hard surface runways in all directions so they can take off and land into the wind from any angle. Now, while we're waiting for the ship to come back over the airport and to come into the mooring mast, let me say a few words about the preparations which have been made here at Lakehurst. Doubtless all of you know that the great part of this naval air base has played in the lighter-than-air transportation here in the United States. The facilities are adequate for the handling of the largest airship built. Just a little piece from where I'm standing is the great mooring mast. To this mast is attached the nose of the airship. It is so constructed that as the winds change, the top of the mast can be turned, allowing the airship to swing with its nose always into the wind. Inasmuch as the Hindenburg is 811 feet long, the mast of necessity must be quite a distance from the hangar, allowing clearance of the ship if it swings around the mast. The landing crew of the air base here is expertly trained to handle these massive ships of the sky. Each man is assigned a particular post, and when the word is shouted that the ship is coming in, this man knows just exactly what is expected of him. That's a fine crew of men, if you've ever seen one. Now, we've been told that the airship is going to make an attempted landing in the rain. And if that is the case, we're going to have a mighty fine description of you because the men will have a difficulty in keeping footing in the sand, and especially since it's wet. Now, the structure is light and yet so strong in the Hindenburg. From the ground, as the ship passed us, we could see the passenger quarters. They're located just about a third of the distance back of the nose, and just about a third of the distance from the keel. They're sort of square in shape and seem to extend the entire width of the ship. There are two decks, A and B, A being the main one and the one where most of the passengers assemble during the passage. Lining the sides of the deck are the observation windows. Now, they're slanted so that it will give anyone in the interior a fine view downward. And no doubt, as the ship went over a number of times, the people were looking down at the great mass of humanity assembled here in the field. Thousands of people have come out to witness the landing of this great airship. Now, there's a long, wide counter inside the observation section of the ship, and you can look down to the ground below, leaning on a table. And below the table, you see a relief map of the various air routes of the world. So as you travel along in the Hindenburg, you can watch the progress shown up on this map. Deck A is the upper of the two decks, and to get to deck B, it's necessary for you to walk through a foyer and down a pair of stairs. There you find what is really a combined smoking room and lounge. Passengers are always thrilled when Captain Max Preuss or Captain Ernst Lehmann will take you a trip to the giant airship. Through its many sections, up and down along the aluminum alloy girders, over the catwalks which lead from one area to another, and then you see a maze of bright metal girders everywhere. And after a walk through the ship, you're ready to rest, for you've covered a great amount of space, and you realize that you have traveled a great distance. Now, they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside, so as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, And what a great sight it is, a thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motor's just roared. The propeller's biting into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. The sun is striking the windows of the observation deck on the eastward side and sparkling like glittering jewels on a background of black velvet. And every now and then, the propellers are caught in the rays of the sun, and their highly polished surfaces reflect circles of gold. Now, a field that we thought active when we first arrived has turned into a moving mass of cooperative action. The landing crews have rushed to their posts and spots, and orders are being passed along, and last-minute preparations are being completed for the moment we have waited for so long. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty proud of a place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows, looking down at the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. And these giant flagships standing here, the American Airlines flagships, waiting to rise into all points in the United States when they get the ship moored. There are a number of important persons is on board, and no doubt the new commander, Captain Max Frisch, is thrilled, too, for this is his great moment, the first time he's commanded the Hindenburg. For in previous flights, he acted as the chief officer under Captain Lehman. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It burst into flame.
It burst into flame and it's falling. It's crashing. Watch it. Watch it, folks. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. Get it, Charlie. Get it, Charlie. It's crashing. And it's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames and it's falling on the mooring mast. And all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's crashing. 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture screaming around here. I can't even talk to people. There's friends around there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honest, it's just laying there, a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can hardly breathe and talk and scream. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside where I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost my voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I've sort of recovered from the terrific explosion and the terrific crash that occurred just as it was being pulled down to the mooring mast. It's still smoking and flaming and crackling and banging down there. And I don't know how many of the ground crew were under it when it fell. There's not a possible chance for anyone to be saved. The relatives of the people who are waiting here, ready to welcome their loved ones that came off this great ship, are broken up. They're carrying them in to give them first aid and to restore them. Some of them have fainted. And the people are rushing down to the burning ship. The fire trucks have all gone down to see if they can extinguish any of the blaze whatsoever. But the terrible amount of hydrogen gas in it just caused the tail surface broke into flame first. Then there was a terrific explosion, and that followed by the burning of the nose and the crashing nose into the ground, and everybody tearing back at breakneck speed to get out from underneath it, because it was over the people at the time it burst into flames. Now, whether it fell on the people who were witnessing it, we do not know. But as it exploded, they rushed back, and now it's smoking, a terrific black smoke floating up into the sky. The flames are still leaping maybe 30, 40 feet from the ground, the entire 811 feet length of it. They're frantically calling for ambulances and things. The wires are being humming with activity. And
I've lost my breath several times during this exciting moment here. Will you pardon me just a moment? I'm not going to stop talking. I'm just going to swallow several times until I can keep on. I should imagine that the nose is not more than 500 feet or maybe 700 feet from the mooring mast. They have dropped two ropes, and whether or not some spark or something set it on fire, we don't know, or whether something pulled loose on the inside of the ship causing a spark and causing it to explode in the tail surface. But everything crashed to the ground, and there's not a possible chance of anybody being saved. I wish I could stop in just a moment and see if I can get my breath again. And Charlie, if you'll fade it out just a minute, I'll come back with more description, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again. I raced down to the burning ship, and just as I walked up to the ship, over climbed over the picket lines, I met a man coming out dazed. He couldn't find his way. I grabbed a hold of him. It's Philip Mangone. Philip Mangone, A-N-G-O-N-E, of New York. Philip Mangone. He's burned terribly in the hands, and he's burned terribly in the face. His eyebrows and all his hair is burned off, but he's walking and talking plainly and distinctly, and he told me he jumped. He jumped with other passengers. Now, there's a Mr. Spey. It sounds like Spey. We're not sure of it. And he also got out, and we noticed the lines, the different lines, the airship lines and the American Airways, their ambulances are down there, and they're taking people out of the wreckage. It seems that a number of them jumped clear when the explosion occurred in the tail. Now, I've just been running up with Mr. Mangone and put him in a car. His wife and daughter met him, and I put them in the car with him and sent him to the field hospital with the other passengers who have been saved. Now, the mass of wreckage is still burning, and I want to repeat again something that I may not have gotten cleared in the hysteria of the moment. The explosion occurred in the tail surfaces, in the fins, the part that was highest, after it had nosed in to go down to the mooring mast. Now, whether something slipped in the back and caused the spark to set off the gas, we do not know. You see, they're using hydrogen in this, or they were using hydrogen in this plane, and it is extremely explosive. In fact, they wear velvet and felt shoes when working among the rafters around hydrogen gas bag. Now, something may have slipped, causing a spark to set off some hydrogen which had leaked out into the structure. It's still burning. I don't know what is burning. Evidently part of the cargo. It's still flaming 10 or 15 feet high. They're still rushing people out of it. Now, it is my sincere hope that as many as possible and as many as I think are out. I think a majority of the passengers jumped when it came close to the ground, according to what Mr. Mangone told me. He says, thank God he jumped, and we say thank God for him also. And it's still smoking. The wreckage is smoking. They've wired all the available services, fire apparatus and everything to come rushing in, and doctors and nurses to come down to take care of the people that are being taken out of the burning wreckage. Now, it lays 811 feet of just smoldering ruins now. I couldn't talk when I saw it. I hope that it isn't as bad as I made it sound there at the very beginning. Now, while I get my breath, I'm going to check and see if there are any more saved out of it. All right, Charlie.
Will you please fade it out, and I'll come in just a bit later.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, we're back with another important bulletin. Mr. O'Loughlin from the Consumers Company of Chicago was one of the passengers aboard the airship when it burst into flames, and he managed to get free of the wreckage, and he's standing here right by my side. I can't ask him to go on there, but he wants me to tell the folks that he is all right. Mr. O'Loughlin of the Consumers Company of Chicago, and here is another man coming in. He's burned considerably, Mr. Otto Clemens. Mr. Otto Clemens is safe, although he's burned quite badly. Now, the Clemens isn't burned at all? Thank you. He's sitting right here. That's composed. And is that his mother with him?
No, that's a friend.
A friend of his? Oh, Mr. Clemens, how did you manage to get out alive?
Yes, sir.
We have to rob the column.
Yes.
He's only speaking.
What is that radio?
Yeah.
Ja. Ich bin von der Passagierkammer, also oben vom Speiseraum, zu meinem Koffer gegangen. Und im Moment kommt nun eine Flamme und das Schiff fängt an zu schwanken, sinkt nach unten und ich springe dann an der Luke heraus, die unten neben der Bar ist. Unten am unteren Gang, wo jetzt die neuen Kabinen eingebaut sind. Ne?
He was on his way to his cabin when the thing...
You tell the folks.
He was on his way to the cabin, when the flash came.
Yes.
And he jumped out.
He jumped out of the cabin?
Jumped out, yes.
And he didn't get hurt a bit in the same
No,
way.
He isn't hurt a bit.
And
not hurt at all.
Oh, I'm so thankful for you. I'm so thankful for you. And you tell him in your language that we're thankful that he got out alive. Now, Charlie, if you're faded out just a minute, I'll see if I can get some more information. And now, friend, I want to tell you, I'm back here, I want to tell you that the wreckage is still flaming out there, but I have some very good news for you. I just came from the front of the building where they have set up an emergency station, and they claim that between 25 and 30, that is the estimate, between 25 and 30 are saved out of the wreckage. Now, I have here a total of 39 passengers and 61 crew. That would make an even 100, but they tell me there were about 106 on board, so that makes 35 out of, between 25 and 30 out of 106 so far saved and accounted for, that if they have been identified. It's still smoking. They can't get to the back part of the wreckage yet. It would be impossible because the flames are, about 10 or 15 feet still leaping in the air. The front part of the ship is intact for about 30 feet back. The nose of it is intact. It evidently had exploded and burned before that part of the ship struck the ground, or even though it was the first part of the ship that should have struck the ground. It didn't. The burning mass held the back of the wreckage into the air. And that, I think, is what saved the passengers for the simple reason that it gave them a time to jump. If the explosion had occurred in the front of the airship, they wouldn't have had time to jump because it would have blown the cabin right out of the bottom of the dirigible. But inasmuch as the flaming mass held the wreckage in the air, that made it possible for them to jump, and we are so thankful because from where we could see, we saw at first every one of them, and the ground crew were gone. But I guess the ground crew had a chance to get out, and it was back, just a little bit back of the picket line, so that none of the spectators got underneath the wreckage. We're so thankful for that. And in checking, not a single spectator, only the persons engaged in the lowering of the giant ship and the people who were on board. Now, we have not received any information as to whether the crew escaped, any of the crew escaped, because they were evidently up in the working part of the ship and wouldn't be down in the passenger compartment. Now, how they managed to jump, I have not been able to determine yet, unless they broke through the windows. Or there may be a possibility that the windows are open. They're open at the top so that they could climb out over and drop down, the man tells me right here. They jumped through the window. Or they didn't stop to open the window. Mr. Clemens here jumped right through the glass window. And it's fine that it was of a breakable nature that they could get out. And therefore save their lives. Now, we can hear the sirens as they're tearing down here beyond us to fight the balance of the fire. The people are crowded down around there. I haven't a very good vision of it. Yes, I do now, right through an open window here, and the people are divided, and I can still see the mass of wreckage burning. I'm standing in the airplane hangar, the airplane division of the Lakehurst Field. It has stopped raining altogether, and it's not hindering the rescue work. If it was muddy and slippery, it would hinder the taking out of survivors. Now, I'm going to stop for a breath of air and see if I can check up and find out if any more or any members of the crew have been saved. All right, Charlie, just a minute. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I've just walked back in here to the office after checking up with a member of the crew. It happened to be Heineberg. Heineberg, he was a member of the crew, is wearing a white coat. I don't know what he was, maybe one of the stewards. He looks like he was one of the stewards. And another man here, and did you know the other man's name? Yes, I announced it, Mr. Kramer. All right, and there's another man just walked up. Mr. Heineberg, too, I want to tell you, is uninjured, and he walked in here with several bundles under his arm. Now, what that man had in his arms when he fell out of the dirigible, I don't know, but he has two paper bundles, and there's not a bit of scorching on either bundle. Now, how it happened, I couldn't begin to tell you, because he landed in, it's fortunate that it was over where there's deep sand, and when they jumped down out of the dirigible, out of the cabin, they lit into the sand, and they didn't receive any broken bones. The ones I have talked to, they're all standing in here getting first aid treatment, and they're awfully shocked, naturally, they would be. But there's no arms or legs broken. They're walking around here talking about it, and some of them are talking in German, and I have to have an interpreter to find out exactly who they are and what capacity they were on the ship. Now, I'm going to stand by for another bulletin. I'm so excited. They've just received now that the four or five airplanes coming over. I'm going to take a look and see. Just a second. Maybe we can hear. They're coming. No. Yes, they're coming in. There's several ships coming in. They've wireless for them. And perhaps you can hear down at the end of the field. I don't know. The sirens are screaming. The mess, the wreckage is still burning. It's been burning now, I should say, approximately 25 minutes or more. It has been burning constantly. What it is that's burning, I don't know, unless it is the gasoline and oil supply, because the smoke is terrific. It's billowing into the sky for a third of a mile high. It is the oil supply. It is the oil supply, because the gasoline supply would have been consumed by this time. And that makes it doubly hard for them to fight the fire on account of it being oil. But there's a lot of sand here, and if they can get close enough to throw sand on it, that might stop some of the blazing. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to stop just a moment. They're needing some help, and I'm going to see if I can't go out and do my part. Just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been 15 minutes since I talked to you last, although we're continuously transcribing this for you. And the fire is still burning out on the field. It is dark now, almost dark, and masses of flame are still leaping from the wreckage. Now, an American Airlines flagship just took off with 21 passengers on board and the stewardess and crew of two. Now, the stewardess is a registered nurse. She has a first aid kit on board the plane, and they have injured in it, rushing them to New York for aid. Now, how many are on board, I don't know. But we have received that 15 out of 16 so far are living. 15 out of 16, and also, I want to mention something else here, too, that some of the crew have been able to get out. Now, there's an officer, a German officer here, speaking to men of his own race, and I cannot understand him, and I'm not going to interrupt him to bother him. But the United States Navy, now let me make a mention here of the United States Navy and what they are doing in this crisis. I never have seen such a smoothly working, systematized action in my life. The men have rushed out there with a firefighting apparatus, had the survivors in the cars and rushed to the hospital before I had time to run down after talking to you to get into the wreckage. Commander Charles Rosendahl The great commander of the United States Navy is out there directing all activities. He's doing a man-sized job for the man that he is, and our credit goes to him. We take off our hat to him. And those sailors and the Marines and the regular Army men and the pilots of both Army and Navy who have flown in here are out there doing their darndest to get the people out of the wreckage. They're still taking people out. Some of them are badly injured. A number of them are dead. Now, we told you there are approximately 106 on board, and so far we have only known of about 25 safely getting away from the wreckage, and we are sure of about 16. Now, if we are going to broadcast any longer here, I'm going to have to step over to the window where the mass of wreckage is still burning out there. To get a better view, I see people walking back and forth in front of an automobile circling it. And inasmuch as that's an oil fire, as I told you before, they can't do much with it. They can't get near it. It's so hot. And I'm going to stand by for another few minutes until I get accurate data to give you. So just stand by. I'll be back with you. I'm back again, ladies and gentlemen, with more information about this terrible disaster down Lakehurst, New Jersey, in which the Hindenburg crashed while being moored at the mooring mast. Three children have been saved. Three children were brought over just for the excitement of the trip, and we're going to be taking back three children by the name of Daner, D-O-E-H-N-E-R, three children by the name of Daner. There was also a radio officer, one of the radio officers of the Hindenburg, jumped through the glass. They had breakable glass in all the windows. Naturally, they would have at that altitude and flying up where it wouldn't hit anything. And he managed to jump, to kick his way out through the deck onto the sand. Now, I figure that there was about 60 feet, a 60-foot drop from the ship. The tail went up in the air, and as I told you on previous occasions, that it held up there long enough for them to jump from the cabin. Now, his name, this radio officer's name, is Schweikard. S-C-H-W-E-I-K-A-R-D. And all I could understand him to say was that he jumped, and evidently was thrown, too, at the same time because the ship was vibrating. There were three distinct explosions, if I remember correctly. I'll have to check back in the earlier part of this broadcast and see if that was not right. The tail surface, then the center section, and then the nose of it destroyed. It's still burning, and I imagine it's now 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. Did you get that? 7:30, and the plane is still burning. Rather, the dirigible is still burning, and I think that, if I'm not mistaken, it has been burning an hour. Am I right in that, Charlie? Just about 1 hour. Because it had stopped raining, and they were coming in for this landing and mooring. We have not yet been able to find out what caused the explosion, but it's very evident that there was a spark set the nitrogen on fire. There wasn't any electricity. There was no electrical storm. It was raining previously to that, but no electricity could have set it on fire unless it was static electricity, because we had had a thunderstorm, a very light thunderstorm, but there was a lot of electricity in the air, so maybe a spark jumped from one of the beams in the tail surfaces across. That would be a logical interpretation of it, inasmuch as they were coming in close proximity to the ground. The static electricity may have increased and caused an explosion like that. Now, we're trying to get more information, and between these broadcasts, we're doing all we can to help the people who are injured. We have most of the living ones in here, back in the German office, in the back part. That is the Hindenburg office, back part of the hangar. They're here. I can't understand half of them. We have an interpreter, and we're getting as much information as we can. Now, Mr. Byrne from the Chicago office and Mr. Reinstrom from the Chicago offices of the American Airlines, that's right, Charlie, American Airlines office, have just came out of the radio room, which is to my back here, and told us that they have sent for all of the available stewardesses
who are on call at Newark to rush by the plane that took the injured people to Newark and bring them back to Lakehurst. Now, just as they are so accurate here, the American Airlines, that I'll tell you what they have done. They have established a directional beam that will guide the ships in here at any hour. Now these ships can leave Newark and find the field, although from the sky they could see the burning wreckage and it would be easily to find, but they can come in here and land, be guided in here and land with their landing lights. So we're expecting a plane load of stewardesses. They're all registered nurses, and they'll be in here very shortly. Now, Commander Rosendahl is over in the main part, over in the lighter-than-air hangar, which is just slightly longer than the Hindenburg. And they have established an emergency hospital base there. They pull tables together, and it houses the Los Angeles and three blimps in there. Now, whether they're taking any of them out to make available room for hospitalization, I do not know, but I will find out and come back later. All right, Charlie, if you'll fade it out, I'll be back in a second. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back again with another flash. I want to tell you that Nelson Morse of Chicago, Nelson Morse, a very well-known Chicagoan on board, is saved. He's safe. We were talking to him, one of the men here, and he is okay. Now, in giving you these names, these German names, such as Dehner and Schweikard and so forth, those are the names the German people have given to me, and being unable to understand the individual person, I'm giving the name as it sounded to me. Now, that is just exactly what is happening. The wreckage is still burning, and we're waiting for a plane to come in with supplies and so forth, and emergency first aid apparatus. And as the events occur, I'm going to come in on this and tell you about it. So just stand by a few minutes, and I'll have more information for you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back again now. It's 8:15. We're terribly upset about this all. The fire is still burning just a little bit now. It's an oil fire, and it's a bad one to fight. We have one of the stewardesses from the ships of the American Airlines, one of the flagships, which came in this afternoon to meet the Hindenburg when it landed. What is your name?
Miss Tyler.
Miss Tyler. Miss Tyler, would you tell me where you've been over? You've been over in the lighter-than-air building, haven't you?
I've been over in the hospital.
Will you go ahead and tell them about it, being over in the hospital?
I've been over in the hospital and seen this terrible calamity over there.
And you're a registered nurse, and have you been working and helping get them out?
Yes,
how many do you have over there, do you know?
Oh, I don't have any idea how many, but it's just an awful lot over there.
Do you think they're 25 or 30?
Oh, there's more than that.
Oh, are they? All right, I won't make you talk anymore. Well, thank you very much, because this is for future records, and anyone that we can get that will give us information on it will certainly appreciate it, and I want to thank you very much. Now, friends, we've just received word that the American Airlines planes are going to be in here in just a very few minutes with all the available registered nurses of their stewardesses at Newark. We're very short of doctors, however, according to the report. The medical doctors of the staff here at Lakehurst, the Navy men, and that are stationed here, are working frantically, doing their best with these nurses who are trained, of course, to the nth degree. They're all registered nurses. They're doing their part in alleviating suffering. Now, as this young lady told you, we don't know how many are over in the lighter-than-aircraft, which houses the Los Angeles. Ships are coming in and out constantly here at the field. They have fixed up an emergency lighting system. Of course, they have the floodlights, but there's an emergency oil fire pot system worked out. And the American Airlines, of course, has a direction beam into Lakehurst so that the American airliners are landing here with their crews and the nurses and doctors and medical supplies. Now, we have just received information that Mr. Lehman, rather Captain Lehman, and Captain Pruss, both of them commanding officers of the lighter-than-aircraft of the Hindenburg and the sister ship that they were going to construct over there, and we have received information that they were saved, and there's another member of the crew, I couldn't get his name, but they were saved and they're in the hospital. Now, there's one of the men just walked in here for first aid, which we gave him. His hands, his arms burned the back of his neck, and the explosion had blown the tops of his shoes off back to the heels. They were just sticking on by laces, and a little bit of the felt covering of the soles of the shoes still still on his feet. His socks weren't burnt off or anything, just the front toes of his shoes. The heels and the soles are intact. Now, that is very strange, showing the terrific force of the explosion as he jumped through the window. And if the sand hadn't been heavy, outside, underneath where the dirigible was coming into land, to be moored to the mast there, none of them would have been saved. Now, of course, they have 42 Navy men frantically searching among the debris down there, which is smoldering now, and every once in a while shooting up a bright flame and sparks, searching to see if they can get any further survivors. Now, these three boys that I told you about have left. Now, there was a slight explosion in the back end of the ship now, and I see flames flying up again, evidently some of the oil supply. And we're going to try and get some pictures, but I've covered everything with the pictures for records, for official records. We're still in the American, the United States Navy aeronautical hangar, the heavier-than-aircraft hangar. There are three planes here. We have the customs officer and all his crew working on the men, the wounded people, and they've stretched out the tables out there and made sort of an emergency cot system for them. The United States government post office is turned over their force to cooperate with the nurses in taking the injured to these tables. All of the government services have been trained to the nth degree. I find that they're steady under the greatest stress. They're calm, reserved, going about their business in an orderly fashion and doing more, perhaps, they and the American Airlines nurses than any other unit I've ever seen, regardless of any place in an emergency act. And they certainly are doing a remarkable job. And I'm going to come back in just a few minutes with another bulletin. It's now 20 and a half minutes past 8 o'clock Central Standard Time, and it's almost 2 hours. Now get this, it's almost 2 hours since the explosion. The explosion occurred at 6:32 Eastern Standard Time, 6:32 Eastern Standard Time, and it is now 8:20 and a half. Almost 2 hours, and there's still spasmodic explosions from the oil in the back part of the dirigible. I'll be back just as soon as I have more information for you. Okay, Charlie.
Back at the flight, ladies and gentlemen. The young stewardess to whom I talked a few minutes ago and who said she would rather not talk has composed herself now. She just came from a trying ordeal over in the lighter-than-aircraft hangar, and she tells me that there are between 40 and 60 alive over there. Between 40 and 60 in the neighborhood of that many. Now, she said that some of them have been have died since they were brought in, and that others are expected to die, but not so many, that some of them have never even been scratched, just a hair singed and eyebrow singed. Now, if there's any more confirmation on the fact of the 40 to 60 alive, I will come in again and give it to you. We were trying to send someone over there, but the lines are so strict that if we once leave the air hangar here, we will be unable to get back in. So we have to stick to our post here and take the people as they come in to report to the German office and be checked in as alive or report someone who has died. Of course, the American Airway Express and all of the people are sending cars out. They're cooperating with the American Airlines in doing this, and everybody's doing his utmost to bring about the easiest end to this terrific tragedy that we've had. Now, I'll be back to the flight later.
There was no more to be recorded. At this point, Herbert Morrison and Charles Nielsen had attempted to contact NBC, whose Blue Network, WLS, was affiliated with at the time. in order to make their recording available to them in New York City. However, the telephone operator Morrison encountered at Radio City in New York refused to believe that a WLS Chicago reporter could possibly have been in New Jersey that night, and promptly hung up on them, assuming it was a hoax. In order to dodge German intelligence officers anxious to prevent the description from being broadcast, they then abandoned their Chicago recorder at the Lakehurst airfield and flew the four transcription discs back to WLS via Newark, Buffalo, and Detroit. Thus, the recordings were first aired locally on WLS the following morning, and then portions were heard over NBC's Red Network just before noon Eastern Time, with NBC's Blue Network airing part of it at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. This was one of the very few times prior to World War II that any nationwide network in the United States set aside its long-standing policy of all live broadcasts in order to air a recording of any kind. Both NBC and CBS had this policy. Morrison never achieved such widespread note after that, although he did eventually get a career boost from the experience. About a year later, he left WLS and was offered a staff announcing job with the Mutual Broadcasting System and local station WOR in New York. He had a fairly successful and lengthy broadcasting career and passed away in 1989 at the age of 83. Of the 97 passengers and crew actually on board that terrible day, a relatively low 13 passengers were killed, along with 22 of the crew and one member of the ground crew. 62 people aboard the Hindenburg survived. In 1975, Universal Pictures produced an epic motion picture titled The Hindenburg, which put forth the theory that political sabotage was the cause of the explosion. Among the co-stars of that film were Charles Durning as Captain Pruss and Robert Clary as a French entertainer. Both actors had survived real-life Nazi atrocities during the Second World War, Durning as an American prisoner of war at the infamous Malmedy, Belgium attack during the Battle of the Bulge, and Clary as an internee at Buchenwald and other concentration camps. Plausible as the movie's sabotage theory may have been, to this date, it is not known precisely what did cause that explosion. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005, produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I do hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.